Hi, and welcome to the Overshoot Podcast,
a 9-part podcast series by the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, IASA.
My name is Frederik Hocke.
And I'm Francesca Gandolfo.
We are climate journalists and founders of Kurzschluss Redaktion based in Vienna.
In this podcast, we will interview 9 experts in different fields to understand how we can cope with a world post 1.5 degrees warming.
Each episode is a little sneak peek into the topics of the Overshoot Conference hosted by IASA in Luxembourg, end of September.
The Overshoot Conference will discuss in depth how we can navigate the risks, trade-offs, and opportunities that come with overshoot scenarios.
We are very excited to be able to talk to some of those experts in advance and hope you enjoy listening to our conversations.
Thanks for tuning in. Hi, everyone, and welcome back one last time for the very last episode of the Overshoot Podcast. Our last guest is Lavanya Rajamani, who is joining us from Oxford today. Thanks so much for taking the time.
It's my pleasure, Francesca. Thank you for having me.
Lavanya Rajamani is a leading expert in international climate change law and environmental governance. She's a professor, legal advisor, and researcher with a focus on climate justice, equity, and treaty design in relation to the Paris Agreement. Rajamani has played a key role in shaping international climate policy. She was part of the UNFCCC core drafting team for the Paris Agreement and was a coordinating lead author for the IPCC's sixth assessment report. Most recently, she was also external counsel for Vanuatu on the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion on climate change. So, in this podcast, we have already talked quite a bit about climate overshoot, but we're yet to hear legal views on this topic. So, Lavanya, how can climate overshoot be understood in the context of the international legal framework?
Thank you, Francesca. I'd like to take us to Article 2 of the Paris Agreement, which is the core provision in the Paris Agreement that deals with the purpose or goal of the Paris Agreement. So the purpose or goal of the Paris Agreement is, in relation to temperature, to reach well below 2 degrees centigrade and pursue efforts towards 1.5 degrees centigrade. The language that the Paris Agreement uses to capture the long-term temperature goal in relation to 1.5 is far more caveated than the language that it uses in relation to the well below 2 degrees centigrade goal. However, in the Glasgow Climate Pact in 2021 and in subsequent COP decisions, parties have actually shifted the emphasis from well below 2 degrees centigrade to 1.5 degrees centigrade. And the International Court of Justice, in its July 23rd advisory opinion, identified the agreed global goal as 1.5 degrees centigrade and indicated that this goal guides the interpretation of the entire treaty, the entire Paris Agreement, which means that the nationally determined contributions of parties should be capable of making an adequate contribution to the achievement of this temperature goal, that is 1.5 degrees centigrade. So we have a clear agreed temperature goal, 1.5 degrees centigrade. But what we don't have clarity on from the Paris Agreement and the international legal framework is by when this goal must be achieved. So Article 2 of the Paris Agreement doesn't actually indicate by when well below 2 degrees centigrade or 1.5 degrees centigrade must be reached, which allows for the possibility that we overshoot 1.5 degrees centigrade and then come back down to 1.5 degrees centigrade. Again, there's no clarity in Article 2 or elsewhere in the Paris Agreement on what the legal limits should be in relation to the duration of the overshoot, for how long we can be beyond 1.5 for 10 years, 20 years, or the magnitude of the overshoot. Should it be just limited to 0.1 degrees centigrade beyond 1.5, 0.2 degrees centigrade beyond 1.5? So no clarity on the duration of the overshoot or the magnitude of the overshoot. But what we know, however, is that from the science, that overshoot has catastrophic planetary implications. So every increment of temperature rise beyond 1.5 degrees centigrade increases the likelihood of high impact climate risks occurring. Some of these are irreversible. So loss of polar and mountain ecosystems, for instance, habitat disappearance, fundamental changes in ecosystems, extinctions of species, melting of ice sheets or glaciers, loss of coral reefs. These are all sort of indicated as potential high impact climate risks in an overshoot scenario. So overshoot emissions may also trigger tipping points that will amplify warming and cause catastrophic impacts. So while we don't know from the legal framework what the duration of the overshoot should be or what the magnitude of the overshoot should be in terms of what the limits are, what we do know is that overshoot does cause catastrophic climate impacts. I would argue that there should be a very stringent standard of due diligence that must be applied to states' actions so that both the duration and magnitude of overshoot is as limited as possible.
When you hear this, Fried and I will explain some terms that maybe not all listeners are familiar with.
Due diligence in the context of climate change refers to the standard of behavior or conduct that is expected of states. States are required to do their utmost and expend their best efforts to address the causes and effects of climate change.
While the Paris Agreement itself doesn't clarify what the duration or magnitude of the overshoot should be limited to, what we can say is that the standard of due diligence that attaches to what states are required to do is stringent and objective. And this has been endorsed more generally in terms of sort of a standard of due diligence for states in relation to climate harms. This has been endorsed in the ICJ's advisory opinion most recently, but also in the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea's advisory opinion last year. So this very high standard of due diligence must be applied to states' actions. So where does this high standard of due diligence come from? It comes from, for instance, best available science in relation to the impacts of overshoot. It comes from the Paris Agreement's agreed global goal, again, limited to 1.5 and not well below 2 degrees centigrade. It comes from the normative pillars of the Paris Agreement, highest possible ambition, progression, common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. It can be also derived from the principles of international environmental law, in particular precaution and harm prevention. And it is also, like I said, in keeping with the interpretations offered by international courts and tribunals in their advisory opinions more recently. So while the legal framework doesn't offer precision in relation to how far it should be limited, it does offer us a framework within which we can apply certain limits to the duration and magnitude of overshoot, or at least can suggest certain limits to the duration and magnitude of overshoot.
Thank you so much for that very compact overview of overshoot in the international legal framework. So you've already said there are some you have some borders in which you can talk about overshoot specifically, but let's talk about the international legal framework a little bit more broadly in terms of climate change. What are the strengths and the weaknesses of the current international legal framework we have?
So the international legal framework comprises of various instruments and also customary international law, and I'll come to that in a minute. But it's not just the international legal framework. We have many regional instruments as well in relation to human rights in particular that can be extended to cover climate impacts. And for instance, the European Convention on Human Rights has been used to address climate harms. You also have domestic legal frameworks. You have climate laws in some jurisdictions, specific climate laws. You certainly have more general environmental laws in many jurisdictions that can also be extended to cover climate harms. But you also have a whole range of other instruments in relation to business, in relation to industry, in relation to taxes, all of which can be used to address climate harms. So when we talk about the legal framework, we're not just talking about a dedicated legal framework to address greenhouse gas emissions. We're talking about a whole host of instruments from the international to the regional to the domestic and in even subnational level. And we're not just talking about legally binding instruments at every level. We're also talking about policies and measures, which may not be legally binding in and of themselves, but are part of a framework of laws and policies that address climate change. So the legal framework is varied and across scales and across jurisdictions and across levels. But if I had to sort of speak about the strengths and weaknesses of particular instruments, let me focus primarily on the international for this purpose. So the international legal framework comprises the UN Framework Convention on the Climate Change, the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement, and Conference of Parties decisions under it. And that's the dedicated sort of climate change regime that we have. And this climate regime has obviously been in evolution for over three decades. And over this time, there have been many institutions that have been set up. There's been much sort of negotiations that have occurred in relation to how we move the needle towards greater climate action, towards greater fairness, towards adaptation and resilience, you know, to ensure that we move towards a climate-safe planet. Now, the strengths of this sort of framework, the international legal framework, is that it now has near universal participation. Obviously, one key actor in particular is outside this regime, but it does have near universal participation. And there is a clear sense among states that everyone must do their part in relation to climate harms. And that is, of course, captured in the Paris Agreement in the notion of nationally determined contributions. So everyone has a legally binding obligation, every state has a legally binding obligation to submit a nationally determined contribution, which signals that everyone has to do their part, everyone is contributing. That is a strength of this agreement, because in a collective action problem such as climate change, we do need everyone, every state, to do their part. Another strength of this international legal framework is also transparency, in that there are many provisions within the Paris Agreement in particular that enhance the quality and quantity of information that we have in the system about what states are doing. So if states are saying that they're going to do something, are they actually doing what they're saying? Now, this, and that's a very simplistic understanding of it, but it does generate considerable transparency, which can then translate into accountability. Even if not accountability within the system, there could be accountability, for instance, from outside the system. There are many non-state actors, research organizations that are trying to generate some sort of pressure on states on the basis of information that states themselves provided about what they're doing. So they're comparing it to what other states are doing. They're looking to see whether the information that's being provided is rigorous, whether it is accurate, whether it's in keeping with the legal obligations of that state. So this does generate some form of accountability, even if it is primarily accountability from outside the system. So transparency is a huge strength in this regime. Another strength of this regime is also that there are regular check-in points at the global level. So for instance, the global stocktake, which occurs every 5 years. So in addition to the nationally determined contributions, in addition to the sort of ex ante and ex post reports that are produced by states, we have global stocktakes, right? So that are regularly reviewing this information and seeing whether collectively states are moving towards the global goals, not just the temperature goal, but all the global goals in the Paris Agreement. In relation to the regular check-in points, we also have, obviously, the annual conferences of parties. And perhaps one of the strengths of the Conference of Parties is that it is a moment every year where there is attention on what states are doing. And that is the positive aspect of the media attention, although there are some negative aspects to it, which I might come to in due course. But one of the positive aspects is it does shine a light on what states are doing. And there is a sort of annual moment of reckoning, as it were, for states in relation to climate change. So these are all the strengths of the international regime, both substantively and in terms of process.
Can I quickly just try to summarize that I've understood everything correctly that you're saying? So basically, you're saying it is internationally legally binding, a legal framework that we have, a binding framework that we have. Mm-hmm. But with quite a clear roadmap as well. Mm-hmm. But it is binding, but there are maybe the consequences of when states don't adhere to the goals are on an international level maybe not so clear, but it still creates accountability because other actors can point out what's not happening or what's not happening enough.
Exactly. So while there are some accountability gaps in the system, and I can speak to them, you know, in a minute in response to your original question about both the strengths and weaknesses of the international climate change regime, there are some accountability gaps in the regime, and some of those accountability gaps can actually be plugged by actors outside the regime. So yes, the transparency helps with sort of plugging those accountability gaps from outside the regime. So which actually takes me to sort of the second part of the question that you asked about the weaknesses of the international regime or the legal framework. So there are some, you know, key substantive weaknesses in the international legal framework, and there have been many efforts to try and plug these sort of substantive weaknesses. And when I say substantive weaknesses or gaps, these are gaps that are consciously negotiated. So states did consciously negotiate these gaps because that is what they could agree to at the time. And this is what some states at least wanted, and that was sort of the deal that was struck between states. So one of the gaps is an adequacy gap, which is perhaps for our purposes in terms of sort of, you know, reaching 1.5 and the overshoot discussion we've been having is sort of a very key gap in that while states are legally obliged to produce nationally determined contributions on a regular basis, and there are sort of legally binding procedural obligations in relation to transparency and many other things in the Paris Agreement, what they don't have is an obligation to take on contribution or a target that is of a particular sort or of a particular level of ambition. So there isn't an obligation in relation to the content of the nationally determined contribution, and there isn't an obligation of result attached to it, which means that while states might choose a X or Y target, they're not obliged to actually achieve X or Y target. So they are obliged to demonstrate progress towards X or Y target. So they have to provide information suggesting that they are taking steps towards X or Y target. But if they don't actually achieve X or Y target, there is no legal consequence that follows, at least within the system. So that is a sort of significant substantive gap or weakness in the regime. But like I said, a consciously negotiated sort of gap or weakness. There are also challenges with respect to fairness, because, of course, fairness is an issue that has been at the heart of the climate negotiations right from the beginning, fairness and equity. So right from the late 80s when the negotiations started, you know, the contentions around fairness and equity emerged and continued throughout the three-decade history of the climate negotiations. There's fundamentally different views on what fairness means, what justice means in this context, what equity means in this context. And states have not been able to sort of resolve this in any particular fashion. The Kyoto Protocol contained a version of a burden-sharing agreement between developed and developing countries, but that proved politically unpalatable. And the Paris Agreement took a step away from trying to resolve this burden-sharing question by essentially leaving it up to states to choose for themselves what they would do. And in the notion of self-differentiation, as it were, if states were choosing for themselves what they would do, they were differentiating themselves from every other state. And that's the form of differentiation that we see in the Paris Agreement, which effectively sidesteps the equity issue. Because you're not telling states what they need to do. If you were telling states in a prescriptive fashion what they needed to do, you could say, well, you know, based on your historical responsibility, current sort of emissions and the trajectory plus your GDP, you should be doing X. We're not saying that. So there isn't a burden sharing arrangement. And in fact, the question of a burden sharing arrangement has been sidestepped. So there are sort of limited avenues for that in the climate change regime. And that is a weakness. I guess in relation to weaknesses, there's also sort of a weakness in relation to implementation, in that while the nationally determined contributions contain a core unconditional element, some of them also contain conditional elements, in that states will do X or Y, which is more than what they have promised to do in their unconditional element, if they're given finances to do it, if the finances are in the system or if the support is in the system. And there just isn't enough finance in the system. So we know the IPCC's sort of sixth assessment report found that current financial levels were 3 to 6 times below what we need for well below 2 degrees or a 1.5 degree pathway. So that is also sort of a key weakness in the system. We just don't have enough resources to deliver all the NDCs, the full sort of gamut of nationally determined contributions from states.
Great. Let's talk about fairness and justice a little bit more. So you've already talked why it's difficult to address them in the current international legal framework, but what is needed to better address them? How could they be addressed better?
One of the challenges with addressing the issue of fairness is how we actually determine what each state's fair share should be. Well, there's the general acknowledgement that everyone should do their part. And I spoke to this earlier. there's also an understanding that every state must do their fair share and that not every state's share is going to be the same. You know, the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities sort of animates the entire regime. So every state should do their fair share, but we don't know what exactly this fair share is and how we determine this fair share. Now, in the literature, there are many objective criteria that have been suggested for determining each state's fair share. And in the negotiations as well, over the years before the Paris Agreement was negotiated, states have suggested many criteria. The only avenue currently that we have to discuss criteria for determining fair share right now is in relation to a decision that was taken by Conference of Parties, where states are encouraged to provide information on how they think their share is fair or what their contribution is and how that sort of relates to fairness. States have chosen various objective criteria to justify their share as fair. And what we find, though, by looking at all these criteria is that states do tend to choose objective criteria, yes, but very subjectively. So they'll choose the criteria that they think most serves their interpretation of fairness. So to give you one example, for instance, many states argue that their share of global contributions to greenhouse gas emissions is so limited, it is so small, that whatever they do in relation to addressing climate change and greenhouse gas emissions is fair. But if you added up all the countries that claim that their share of the global burden is so limited, it amounts to about a third of global greenhouse gas emissions. 110 states, for instance, said this in the first nationally determined contribution. So what we currently have in the system is use of criteria, objective criteria, but very subjectively. So one of the things that we can do is to look at these criteria and determine which of these criteria actually fit within the legal framework that I spoke about earlier. But I've done some work with some fabulous colleagues from New Climate, Nicholas Honey, Louise Jeffrey, and others, looking at how we determine fair shares for states and how we do that within the framework of principles of international environmental law. And some criteria are actually excluded by the principles of international environmental law. So there are ways of determining fair shares of states, and increasingly this is going to become a central issue, especially in climate change litigation. So there are possibilities, certainly. And how we determine fair shares in the context of states' burdens in relation to climate change will also extend to overshoot. But there are some open questions there. So for instance, will overshoot shift the burden of responsibility differently? Will urgency and temporal dimensions of this challenge in the context of overshoot again change the burden of responsibility? So there are some open questions, which I'm very much hoping that we will be able to discuss later this month.
Before we get to an end of this episode, I would also like to ask you a bit more personal insight, because you've been involved in climate treaty negotiations and climate litigation. So what insights can you share with us from sitting at the table? You've already talked a bit about the limitations of these treaties being only what the countries will agree on can actually be in the treaty. But are there any other unexpected difficulties in these processes beyond the legal framework you can share with us from your insights?
So I think in relation to the negotiations, many of the challenges today are process related. I think, of course, there are substantive gaps, which I've spoken about, in the international climate change regime. But within the context of the international climate change regime, possibly a lot more could be done than is currently being done. And much of this is in relation to the process of getting to a yes in these negotiations. For instance, it's difficult to add things to the agenda that need to be. For example, the issue of carbon dioxide removal, which many of the IPCC, if not all of the IPCC scenarios, suggest that we will be relying on CDR to some extent. But this is not an issue that is discussed in the climate change negotiations. It's very difficult to put it on the agenda of the climate change negotiations because of how difficult it is to get things on the agenda, how difficult it is to actually carve out time for issues on the agenda that actually need to be addressed that will make the process and the negotiations more nimble and dynamic. There are also difficulties with respect to how you make decisions in this process, right? So the default is consensus-based decision-making, and that has proven to be challenging in the past for those that are seeking a more ambitious outcome in these negotiations. So I think there are many process-related challenges in the negotiations. and partly the process-related challenges, but also, of course, the substantive differences in diversity of interest between states has led to some level of loss of confidence among states in relation to each other and in relation to the process. For instance, the financial commitments made by developed countries in relation to the Copenhagen Accord and subsequently the Cancun agreements to reach a particular level of sort of financial provision by 2020 was not reached until 2023. Those kinds of gaps, as far as states are concerned, and those kinds of challenges with promise keeping have led to a sort of failure of confidence in negotiating partners and in the process. So we need to, in international negotiations, scale down and hunker down, in a sense, to what the process can do well, rather than focusing on everything. It's a very narrow window of opportunity. And so, you know, there is a huge amount of pressure on the negotiations. The last point I'd make on conferences of parties is that they have, to some extent, become huge jamborees. It's sort of a huge circus. And there's a pressure to produce sort of big announcements every year. And so the host governments, the presidencies usually do sort of try and deliver some big announcements, but that there's very little follow-up of those. And there's only so far we can go with big announcements without sort of sufficient follow-up and accountability, which the system needs to generate more of. As far as litigation is concerned, my experiences with the litigation aspect of addressing climate harms, I think as a practitioner, we've seen huge advances in the law, much beyond what we thought we could get. The ICJ's advisory opinion on climate change, for instance, has been a huge and significant, tremendous win for vulnerable countries. Much of it was unexpected, I should say, even by those who were in the system. Much of it was unexpected. But these cases take several years. The ICJ's advisory opinion was about 5 years in the making from when it was originally conceived to when you actually got the advisory opinion. The wins are case by case. And some of these wins might have political backlash. They often do have political backlash. For instance, the European Court of Human Rights had a very significant judgment in Klimas and Jorinen had huge political backlash in Switzerland. And even in terms of negotiations, some of these advisory opinions might have potentially negative consequences on the negotiations, where states might be even more reluctant to agree to things if they think that what they say in the negotiating context is going to be translated into accountability and it's going to be interpreted differently by international courts and tribunals. So I think there are challenges both with litigation as well as in negotiations. But perhaps I'd like to end on the note that there is some promise and there is some hope, both in the negotiation context and in the climate change context. And I think this is my big takeaway from perhaps a couple of decades of working on this, from my doctoral thesis to where I'm at now, is that the advances we've seen both in terms of treaties and customary international law, as well as in terms of climate litigation, is much beyond what was conceived originally. Whether it's going to be sufficient to deliver a climate-safe planet within the narrow window of opportunity that we have, the jury is out on that. But huge advances, huge promise, some hope. Thank you.
Thank you to Lavanya. That was a really, really interesting insight into the legal framework. I think there will be a lot to discuss at the conference session, a lot of questions that you've already brought up that will be discussed there. Thanks so much for the super interesting talk, Lavanya.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been a huge pleasure to be part of this podcast, and thank you for your great questions.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.
This was the last episode of the YASA Overshoot podcast. If you haven't yet, make sure to also check out our previous episodes. We've spoken with leading climate change experts from various fields to discuss the topic of climate overshoot. If you like this podcast, please share it with others and leave us a positive review. In a few days, the Overshoot Conference will take place at YASA in Luxembourg, Austria, picking up on the themes we've covered in this podcast here. We wish everyone a fruitful discussion.